You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Kevin Richard from Idaho Education News, sitting in for Gemma Gaudette. She's on vacation, the news isn't. So it's time for our Friday Reporter Roundtable, when we get you caught up on all the news that made headlines this past week. Today's panel includes Rachel Cohen, the Twin Falls-based reporter for Boise State Public Radio, Clark Corbin from the Idaho Capital Sun, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Rachel Spacek from the Idaho Statesman. Hello, friends.
Hi, Kevin. Hello. Thanks for having us on.
Hi there.
Hello.
Well, so I think my eyes are no longer twitching over that house assessment that I got in the mail the other day, so I think we can safely talk about what hit the inboxes in the Valley these past few days. Rachel Spacek, give us the big picture here. What the numbers are in Ada County and Canyon County.
Yeah, so I don't think you're the only one whose eyes were twitching when they got their assessments, because I also received some concerns about those numbers people saw in those assessments. But I mean, I think, you know, Ada County Assessor Bob McQuaid kind of said the same thing, is if you've been paying attention to what's happening in the Valley, you might have suspected an increase of some kind. But basically what we're seeing in Ada County is an average 28% increase in assessed values of homes over the past year, and Canyon about a 30% on average increase. And so, you know, this is because of the home sales price increases that we've seen over the last year. The county assessors in both counties were also a little soft on their increases last year because of COVID, and because, you know, they worried about what a large increase in property tax bills might mean for people who were out of work. So that's
right. So there's an element of catch up here.
Yeah, exactly. Some element of catch up for sure. And so for people who don't know, Idaho law requires that assessors are within 10% of actual home sales prices in their assessments. And last year, both counties were a little low. And this year, they're both like at, I think Ada County is like over 95%, and Canyon is around like 98, 99. So, you know, that's kind of what has played into those letters that people got this week.
And the bottom line for listeners, we won't go into the full details, but what happens with your assessment does not directly correlate necessarily with what happens with your property taxes. It's complicated, but this is a big spike in assessments.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and that's something that I've been trying to include in all my stories, and I know Bob McQuaid has tried to say in all of his presentations, is you won't see like a 28% increase in your bill. You know, that is decided once the taxing district set their budgets, which they are still in the process of setting. So yeah, lots of formula goes into it, but basically don't be too worried when you see your assessment, because that's not your tax bill.
And Don, the assessments are connected to some degree, linked. There's a linkage between your assessment and what's happening with the market in general. Home prices blew past a couple of milestones in Ada and Canyon counties just in May. I mean, it's rising prices, limited inventory, seller's market. Give us the numbers.
Yeah, you know, we talk about this on Idaho Matters a lot, and it is worth continuing to talk about the numbers. The median home price in Ada County stood at $523,000. That's the first time that it went past the $500,000 mark, which frankly is sort of a key psychological milestone, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But in Canyon County, the median price of a home hit $410,000. That's the first time that homes there crossed the 400K mark. And what's interesting in Canyon County is that price was under, that median price was at $300,000 just a year ago in July of 2020. And so we've seen a significant run up in those prices. It's not surprising to anybody. I think it's important to say that we are seeing a pretty significant appreciation in the national median home price. Sometimes it's easy here in the Treasure Valley to go, gosh, our house prices are going up so fast and it's just a Boise problem or an Ada County, Canyon County problem. It's not, although the prices are certainly ahead of the national average. What caught my eye this month from April to May data is that that Ada County price really spiked a lot. It's normal to have it go up, you know, maybe $20,000. But what happened is in April, it was at $481,000. And then in May to that $523,000 mark, which is a really fast, steep climb. We'll see if that settles out when we get, you know, our June numbers here in about a month.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, where does this go? I mean, where do we go from here?
I don't know. One of the most frequent conversations I have is this a bubble or is this systemic? And I think that the answer is both. I think that there are some major systemic things that have happened that have changed the market here. I also think that you are seeing some effects of a housing bubble probably across the nation, mm-hmm. but don't look for home prices in Ada County to suddenly be back under 400,000 or under 300,000 anytime soon. It's just not going to happen. Will it slow down? Maybe, but we aren't seeing a lot of signs of that. In fact, the other key metric that we look at is how quickly the average home sells. So if you put your house on the market, how many days does it take until that house goes to pending? And this number just keeps getting faster and faster, and it kind of blows my mind. In April, that number was at 14 days for Ada County. It ticked up 2 days to 12 days. And it's just improbable that will continue to climb. Obviously, eventually that number has a hard ceiling, right? You know.
It gets to zero at some point, right?
Yeah. But the people that I know that have sold homes here in the last 6 or 7 months have sold them pretty quick. And honestly, we had some good friends who moved to the East Coast and sold their Boise home, and they listed their house, but they actually said they like listed it on a Wednesday, and they didn't even read any offers until the following Monday. So you're looking at a 5-day time frame, and then took a few more days to negotiate. I imagine if they said we want to sell it tomorrow and we'll go pending tomorrow, the day after they listed it, they could have. So even that 12 day, I think is maybe artificially inflated a little bit by people taking a bit of time to really call for offers.
Wow. And Clark, I mean, all of this comes on the heels of this marathon legislative session that we both covered, which culminated with this last minute overhaul of the property tax structure. I mean, I've got to think that as all of this is happening in the Treasure Valley, you've got homeowners and policymakers wondering if what the legislature did this past May is going to make a difference.
Yeah, Kevin, I think that, you know, that's a real open question at this point. That did materialize in the last few days of the longest session in state history, as you pointed out. That bill did a couple of things. It increased the homeowner's exemption, but it also pushed people off the circuit breaker, depending on, you know, their economic situation with their household there. And so it is going to be interesting. This was one of the big issues for Idahoans heading into the session. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody's been talking about crazy property values, talking about their tax bills. And is this bill that the legislature passed into law going to do enough or not? And I think it's an open
question.
Everybody
wanted something done.
Yeah, they did get something done, but I think until we see those municipal budgets set and we see exactly what those tax bills are going to be, I think a lot of people will still see, I think it's likely that a lot of people will still see the amount of property taxes they actually pay increase, even with that bill. And so I think it's a complicated situation. I think it's an open question of whether this was the relief that Idahoans would wanted. And I just think we don't know right now, but that bill may not have been the silver bullet that some folks would have liked it to have been, right?
Yeah. And Rachel Cohen, the issue of housing shortages really took on a very sobering tone in the Wood River Valley recently with the discussion of trying to create a tent city in Ketchum. Not surprisingly, emotions ran pretty high about this.
Yeah, I think, you know, the reactions are not surprising. But the housing crisis here has really seemed to reach a sort of tipping point. I mean, while the issue of affordability has been around for decades, you know, the pandemic really exacerbated all the trends that have made the area increasingly unaffordable for the people who work there. And so you kind of have that going, and you also have the fact that people are really talking about it now. You know, I've only been covering the area for 2 years, but this is the first time I've really seen any sort of advocacy around housing, you know, people showing up to meetings and demanding action. And so while the, you know, Tent City headlines definitely, you know, brought the attention toward the issue, those discussions are really happening because the community is demanding some level of action from the city.
And no easy solution to a problem that's festered there for years.
Yes. So I think we're going to see in the coming weeks what sort of short-term solutions the city goes with. I think that, you know, some of the council members were still interested in seeing if they could allow some sort of city camping, whether it's in tents or RVs, to alleviate some of the immediate pressure. You know, they moved away from an initial option of a city park, but I think some council members are still interested in exploring other locations.
We're going to take a short break. We will have more with our reporter roundtable in 2 minutes, and we will turn to two completely unrelated acronyms, CRT and ACHD. I'm Kevin Richard, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Kevin Richard. Continuing our reporter roundtable, our guests today, Rachel Cohen, the Twin Falls-based reporter for Boise State Public Radio, Clark Corbin of the Idaho Capital Sun, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Rachel Spotcheck at the Idaho Statesman. Clark, I'm going to start with you this segment, and we'll talk about how we're both going to be spending our summer covering the ongoing uproar over critical race theory and claims of indoctrination in Idaho schools. You spoke with the National Observer this week, and what did he have to say?
Yeah, this has really become one of the dominant stories, both in education and in politics. And it's not just in Idaho, Kevin. I spoke with Eric Ward, who's the executive director of the Western States Center in Portland, Oregon. He's also a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, kind of an expert on race and extremism. And what he said is that these attacks on critical race theory, which we're seeing in Idaho and in a growing number of states, he said it's an effort by conservative Republicans to exploit this anxiety that many voters may be feeling as this country is going through changes, demographic changes, mm-hmm. economic changes, cultural changes. So Eric is saying that conservative Republicans have used critical race theory to exploit that fear and to distract from some of the actual issues that are going on. But really, it's about engaging and mobilizing voters ahead of next year's election cycle. And it was interesting to talk with Eric because it sort of reassured me that, like, what we're seeing in Idaho, it isn't abnormal. It's happening in a lot of other states. And when I was talking with Eric, he actually talked about how former President Trump kind of really, really added a lot of steam to this debate about critical race theory, sort of in response to a New York Times Magazine project called the 1619 Project, which won the Pulitzer Prize and was examining slavery in America. President Trump criticized that. He criticized critical race theory, calling it anti-American indoctrination. And then President Trump created something called the 1776 Commission, which he designed through executive order to kind of develop this more patriotic education curriculum. And the quote that President Trump had was to teach our children about the miracle of American history is what he called it. Shortly after President Biden took office, he undid President Trump's 1776 right. commission. And then at this point, we see President Trump, former President Trump, really start to attack critical race theory. He appeared at a Republican convention in the last couple of weeks and called upon states to ban critical race theory from their schools, from their states, from their workplaces. And it's something that's on Fox News often. It's something that's come up in several other states. Idaho's Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan has created a task force, which is looking at what they're calling indoctrination in our schools using critical race theory. And Lieutenant Governor McGinn has been quoting President Trump and some of his talking points, calling on people, calling on states to repeal critical race theory, which, Kevin, this was a very new topic to me this year. It sort of felt like to me it came out of nowhere this legislative session. And I talked to Eric about what critical race theory really is. And he said that it kind of originated with these academic writings, these scholarly writings in the 1970s and 1980s that were really examining the impact of legacy and race and injustice in America's legal system and the court system. He said it's really about examining systems and institutions, not individual people. And Eric highly doubts that it's being taught in public schools in Idaho, even though this was like the big argument that Republicans used. Mm-hmm. They used it to kill a federal grant of $6 million for early childhood
education grant
in Idaho. They cut funding to colleges and universities, and they held up the public school budgets over this debate. And kind of crucially, the Republicans making these arguments, from where I stand, they haven't really demonstrated that it's happening in Idaho. They haven't really given concrete examples of even what it is, let alone whether it's happening in Idaho. And so that sort of fits in with what Eric was telling me about using it to sort of mobilize voters. And I think it's important to know, and I think everyone knows at this point, that Lieutenant Governor McGeehan, who's the co-chair of this task force, is seeking higher office. She's running for governor, and the co-chair of the task force, State Representative Priscilla Giddings, a Republican from Whitebird, is running for higher office as well. She's running for lieutenant governor next year. We do have three more of these education task force meetings coming up in Idaho. The next one is at the end of this month at the State Capitol building. But Kevin, I know you and I were both at the first one in late May. It went for about 5 hours. And it's kind of this handpicked task force that Lieutenant Governor McGeehan put together. But during the whole five-hour debate, they didn't take any public comment, and they didn't ask any people of color to talk or to speak or to share their thoughts at all. And so actually, Idaho Education News reported last week that the president-elect of the Idaho School Boards Association withdrew from this education task force, saying that it was really about campaigning, and then they weren't taking a serious look at what could be a sensitive issue. And so this really has become a huge debate in political and education circles, and we have heard far from the last of it. It's like you said, Kevin, this is what our summer is going to be, and it's going to be a huge talking point in next year's elections as well, I imagine.
It feels like we have a new headline on the story almost every day. You mentioned the ISBA pulling out of Lieutenant Governor McGeehan's task force. You at Idaho Capital Sun have been embroiled in a dispute with Lieutenant Governor McGeehan's office over a public records request that hasn't been complied with. Priscilla Giddings filed a public records request with the Boise School District and was told that what she wanted would cost more than $100,000. I mean, there's a story every day on this topic.
There's a story every day on this topic. A secondary headline within my story today, which you can find at idahocapitalsun.com. A secondary story was that the Idaho Freedom Foundation has been taking credit for what they called a never-before-seen reckoning in Idaho education. We obtained a letter that Wayne Hoffman, the president of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, sent to prospective donors in May, this long, rambling, seven-page letter, where the Idaho Freedom Foundation took credit for the anti-indoctrination bill. I think that's House Bill 377, which every Republican in the House and Senate who was present voted for. The Idaho Freedom Foundation took credit for killing off the $6 million federal grant, which originated with the Trump administration for early childhood education in Idaho. And they took credit for basically the budget debates that wound up with reducing funding to Idaho's colleges and universities due to so-called social justice programming. And so there's so many different layers to what's going on. This is a huge story, and it's only going to become more of a story as I see it.
Yeah. So I promised we would shift gears from CRT to ACHD. I didn't promise how we'd do it, but here we go. ACHD, Salt Shed, on the move from Garden City to Boise, but that's not really the end of the story, Don. So get us started on this.
Yeah, and you know what? I know Rachel also reported on this. Boise Devs' Margaret Carmel has been following this for a while. This is one of those stories that we've kind of been looking at, and we've done a little bit on, and it's one of those things where it's like, is this inside baseball? But the Highway District has quite a bit of land holdings in Garden City near the river. And as anybody who's paid attention to Garden City knows, that whole area is really rapidly redeveloping. And you can imagine why. It's close to the center of town. It's right on the river. And historically, it's been home to, you know, industrial areas and empty lots and some homes.
And that's how you get a maintenance shed right on the banks of the river virtually.
Yeah, exactly, right? So this salt shed is basically what it sounds like. It's a big shed for salt that they use in the wintertime. And Garden City doesn't want it there. ACHD doesn't want to move it. They came basically to a realization at the Highway District that they needed to give it a new spot. And so they have basically found new locations for their facilities. But they say that it's not going to happen right away. This is going to take time to do. And Garden City is kind of like, well, tough. You need to do it quicker. That's kind of the high level. And Rachel probably can fill in some of the details there.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, Rachel Spachek, I mean, you've been covering this, and there is some legitimately bad blood here between Garden City and ACHD. You've got city officials feeling like they've been misled, and ACHD took this issue to the legislature, and I think that probably rubbed some of the proverbial salt into the wound. I mean, city officials are not happy right now.
Took them to the woodshed.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, technically, the conditional use permit for the salt shed expires today, and you know, like Don mentioned, ACHD doesn't have plans to move it today, so it's unclear. And I mean, in my story, and I know Margaret Carmel also said this in a press release that ACHD sent, you know, the plans are maybe going to take years, like maybe five. Longer. So yeah, a lot is unsure at this point, but you know, like Don mentioned, it's clear Garden City does not want this structure anymore, and you know, has concerns for residents in that area, and yeah, so it's kind of crazy, and there was a petition for judicial review when Garden City initially denied a one-year extension for the permit, and then kind of while that was ongoing, it was paused because ACHD went to the legislature to ask for a bill that would basically you know, say that highway districts don't have to comply with city ordinances and city asks. So, and that bill was held in committee. Right. And basically the legislature said, you know, this sounds like this bill would only solve the Garden City ACHD problems, which isn't the legislature's role. So you guys kind of need to figure that out. So ACHD was bringing, you know, asks for an extension to a couple Garden City meetings recently. And the council was basically like, you know, this permit was for 3 years and you've had all of that time to get it solved. So we're not going to extend it. So basically still up in the air.
And I think it's worth probably saying that one of the things that ACHD says too is, in their defense, that having it here in Garden City is helpful because it's central to a lot of the roads that most often need maintenance, and some of the other locations may be further out. It's also co-located right across the street or right nearby the ACHD headquarters and offices. So that's part of the reason that they, I think, have fought so hard to keep it here because they like the location, frankly.
And while you've got this impasse between ACHD and Garden City over a salt shed, ACHD announced some changes in how they're going to approach bike lanes. And this is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, you know, this is actually a really big deal. And I was surprised when I heard it. So Boise Dev's Autumn Robertson reported on this week. And the Highway District says that going forward, when it builds bike lanes on arterial roads, and that's a piece of jargon, and it essentially means that the more major roads, think, you know, Fairview Avenue or Meridian Road, those types of things, that they will separate the bike lanes from the vehicle lanes. Now, this can be done in a number of ways. Some of it may be with a barrier, some of it may be done by attaching the bike lane to the sidewalk. There are a very few of these separated bike lanes in the county presently. I believe the Cloverdale, right. New Cloverdale overpass has one. Yep. There is one along Capitol Boulevard in downtown. That was actually a huge fight between the city and ACHT, the city of Boise, speaking of fights, a few years ago, but that went in. So this is a pretty big change for the cycling community. And we talked to Joe Jasuski, who is on the pedestrian advisory committee. And he's very excited. The group of cyclists who commute in this town are very excited. After we wrote our story, Nate Shellman on KBOI radio did an hour on it. And it was interesting. And I listened to it. Actually, Joe called in and kind of debated with Nate, which was pretty funny. He played Freddie Mercury's bicycle song from Queen. But the callers on the show were all pretty concerned about the fiscal impact. ACHD told us that they didn't know how much these new lanes would cost. And Nate, on a fairly conservative talk show, picked up on that and said, in essence, that, boy, you know, we're going to do all this. How much is it going to cost? And callers were saying that the bicyclists should help pay for this. So no thing is without controversy in 2021, this included.
Ain't that the truth? Rachel Cohen, you've been reporting on COVID vaccination trends in the state and the Magic Valley, and you spoke to some folks in the Magic Valley who are good with waiting, you know, as these vaccination numbers continue to slow down.
Yeah, it was interesting because I just went up and talked to people and asked, you know, their thoughts about the vaccine, and very quickly found people who kind of fit into the buckets that the state has identified through surveys. And so in one recent survey that was completed in about mid-April, they found a third of Idahoans say they definitely don't want the vaccine. So I did talk to someone who was in that category. And she just said, you know, she had COVID. She didn't, you know, react too poorly to it. And so she felt that she just wasn't too worried about getting the virus again. You know, the fear of COVID wasn't great enough for her to make her want to get the vaccine. And, you know, yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
And it all comes as we're hearing from the state that most of the new coronavirus cases are involving people who are unvaccinated.
Yeah, that was some news from the health department briefing this week. They said about 90% of recent COVID cases in Idaho were among people who were unvaccinated, or at least the state didn't have any record that they had mm-hmm. been vaccinated. Right. And they're saying, you know, that's evidence that vaccines work. You know, they do protect people from getting the virus, but also if you are unvaccinated, you're still vulnerable to the virus. Some experts say maybe even more so right now because of the new variants. And that's all, although the case rates in Idaho right now are quite low.
But also the vaccination numbers have dropped really sharply over the past couple of months.
Right. The weekly vaccination numbers are kind of looking like what they were in the beginning of the year when the eligibility, you know, was definitely nowhere near what it is now. It's definitely slowing down, and the state is kind of calling it a trickle. And so they're having to adjust their approach even from the stage where we've been in the past couple months, which is mobile clinics. You know, they're even having to go smaller than that.
So two other news items that broke on Thursday. Clark, some news from Reclaim Idaho, moving ahead on a K-12 funding initiative, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. There's a catch, and we'll get to that. But yeah, I spoke with Reclaim Idaho co-founder Luke Mayville on the phone yesterday. That's the group that was behind the 2018 rather Medicaid expansion in Idaho. That's the same group. Nice. They got the go-ahead from the Idaho Secretary of State's office to go ahead and begin collecting signatures for a new ballot initiative. They're looking to increase education funding by raising income taxes. They hope to get that on the 2022 ballot, and they officially got the ballot titles approved by the state this week. So that's what gave them the green light to go ahead and collect signatures. You can read the petition. There's a link on our website, the Idaho Capital Sun. You can find it on Reclaim Idaho's website as well. But the wrinkle is, and I talked to Luke about this, he said they really don't know what the signature gathering requirements are right now. And I'm going to take you back to this year's legislative session. Mm-hmm. The legislature passed a new bill, which Governor Brad Little signed into law, Senate Bill 1110, which changes the signature gathering requirements, making it so that organizers of either a initiative or a referendum would have to get 6% of signatures from registered voters in all 35 Idaho legislative districts, up from the previous requirement of 18. Reclaim Idaho has filed a lawsuit with another group seeking to overturn that law, and the Idaho Supreme Court has indicated that they're going to hear arguments on that case at the end of this month. I think it's on June 29th or thereabouts. Yeah. And so the catch is, Reclaim Idaho is hoping that they're going to prevail and be successful with their lawsuit. If they do that, they're hoping for an expedited ruling. They would then stage some large-scale kind of kickoff signature type gathering events. If they lose, and if Idaho's law is upheld, Reclaim Idaho would likely shift gears. And instead of doing the education ballot initiative, they would move forward with a ballot initiative, which would be basically designed to take Idaho back about 10 years, loosen up the requirements for signature gathering, to return it to the threshold of just getting 6% of signatures from voters statewide, regardless of what legislative district they're in. It may seem like a little bit of splitting hairs, like what's the difference 6% statewide versus 6% in every legislative district. But when I talked with Reclaim and some of the other folks who oppose this new ballot initiative law, they said the new requirement to go to all 35 legislative districts makes it so that organizers have to travel to like the most rural and remote and isolated parts of Idaho to gather those signatures. And they're saying it would make it maybe impossible to get an initiative or a referendum on the ballot. On the other hand, the folks who support Senate Bill 1110 said it's all about making sure that Idahoans in all corners of the state do play a role in that initiative process. So that's several things that we're going to be watching. I know that we're going to be covering the Supreme Court hearing at the end of this month, looking for a decision, and then finding out, you know, is Reclaim going to go ahead with the education ballot initiative? If they lose, are they going to focus on the ballot initiative? So it's another interesting situation right now, very much an unfolding story that I know, Kevin, both you and I will be covering, along with a lot of other reporters.
Yep. So, Don, not a Friday afternoon news dump, but an after-hours news dump on Thursday from City Hall. This is all regarding Interfaith Sanctuary and the homeless shelter proposal. So what news broke and where are we going from here?
Yeah, just after 5 o'clock yesterday, the city of Boise sent out a news release that said that Boise Mayor Lauren McClain had asked leadership of the Interfaith Sanctuary to put a pause on their proposal to build a new homeless shelter along State Street. Boise Dev's Margaret Carmel has been covering this really all year, and neighbors are unhappy about the prospect of converting the former Salvation Army facility there on State, right by Flying Pie, into a large homeless shelter. The Interfaith Sanctuary folks have made a number of changes to the proposal and then formally filed it right at the end of April, early May. And hearings haven't been set. It would need a conditional use permit from the city of Boise to move forward. And there's also some funniness, I think might be the best way to put it, because Interfaith Sanctuary has actually sold the building and land for its current shelter in the River Street neighborhood to the former CEO of Albertson's Companies, and they've purchased the land underneath the new shelter. And so the city is in this position where they've got this proposal and kind of have some pressure to approve it, but not everybody's happy. In fact, Margaret Carmel went and spoke to members of the homeless community, and they were divided. It wasn't just a clean split that people thought that this was the best idea. So The mayor called up Jody Peterson-Steigers yesterday and said, hey, you know what? I'd like to put a pause on this for 8 weeks, and we're going to form a task force that's going to have some specific goals to move this project forward. We had some questions for the city. The city spokesperson wasn't immediately able to answer those. And after we published our story, the mayor called me and tried to fill us in on some of those details. She said that they would look to form the task force with obviously representatives from Interfaith, but Boise Police, as well as city employees who are working in the homeless community. And so we'll know a little bit more, I think, next week on what the form of this is going to look like. What's interesting is in her video message that was posted to the city's social media channels, she said, you know, I'll quote her. She said, I want to be clear that this shelter could well be on State Street. It might be on a piece of property nearby that the city has. And so I went, well, what property is that if there's another idea? So I asked the mayor, and she said that she misspoke in the video and clarified that the city does not have a specific piece of property on State Street identified. She told me, quote, we are doing an assessment of the parcels the city owns, the land we have available that we could put to housing needs. So, you know, your producer asked me before we went on the air if I knew where they might look. I don't. The city owns pieces of property all over town. It's their city. They own pieces of property. So we'll see what this looks like. We'll see where this goes. Boise Devs, Margaret Carmel, who has been following this, will continue to follow this, and we'll be looking at this really closely as it moves forward, because I know a lot of people are really interested in what happens here.
Rachel Spacek, a story out of Eagle this week, long-standing dispute over who's going to acquire Eagle Water Company. There is a buyer, and the bottom line for consumers is their rates are going to go up. So what's happening here?
Yeah, so for some reason this week I was thrown into these, like, I don't know, entity issues that are finally either being solved or not solved. But yeah, so this is the one that has, I think, been a battle, if you will, for a few years between the City of Eagle, Eagle Water Company, and Suez Water Company, which it's the water company that serves most of the Treasure Valley, I think, the valley's largest water company. And so originally Eagle Water was going to sell to them, and then the City of Eagle was concerned with that increase in water rates. And also since Suez is valley-wide, you know, Eagle didn't want, I guess, its water supply to be diverted to other places. But the current mayor, Mayor Jason Pierce, and Suez resolved a lawsuit earlier this year, and basically Suez was able to move ahead with refiling an application with the Idaho Public Utilities Commission to acquire the Eagle Water System. So that will add about 12,000 people in Eagle and other places outside to the Suez network. And so these bills, if that goes through, are going to increase by a good amount this year, based on the press release I saw. Based on a current average monthly bill of $12.35 for a residential customer using about 12,000 gallons per month in 2021, that will look like a $7.13 or 58% increase. And then the increase gets lower as the years go by, but, you know, pretty hefty increase this year if that goes through. Same increase in commercial customers, average monthly bill of $38 using 56,000 gallons per month. We'll see a $40 average or 103% increase this year. So, so hefty increases to be seen if that goes through. That was a concern for the city, as I mentioned, and that's why they wanted to buy the water company. But Pierce said that, you know, Eagle Water Company might have needed some repairs and just some upgrades that the city wasn't ready to drop money on that a private company was able to. And then Suez also said it has a large customer base, so it can provide maybe some customer service that Eagle Water wasn't able to. But yeah, so some changes to water in Eagle are coming potentially.
And shifting around here as we try to get to as much as we can here in the few minutes we've got left. Clark, wouldn't be a week without political intrigue. We're expecting news from Ammon Bundy next Saturday, but he's not being welcomed into the Republican fold with open arms exactly.
No, he's not. And I'll be out there next Saturday at that park in Meridian for whatever this announcement is going to be. But yeah, kind of a pushback from the Idaho Republican Party and from Tom Luna specifically talking about how the Republican Party is the party of law and order, and they're not sure that that Ammon Bundy, who's known as an anti-government activist and the head of the people's rights movement, who actually is facing charges and a ban from the Idaho State Capitol building right now, they're saying that he doesn't fit within their party. And so really, really a lot of interesting races heading into the 2022 election. That governor's race is one of them. Curious to see what Ammon does and what role he plays if he does go through. And I guess the thing to keep in mind
he's
is
filed you paperwork. Guys know, I mean, he's named a treasurer.
Yeah, he's just filed paperwork, but the official filing period doesn't even open until next February.
He's named a campaign treasurer for a gubernatorial campaign if he goes through with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the paperwork that he filed. Still a long ways off from that primary, but just a crazy election cycle already, even just a year out from this primary, just less than a year out. But yeah, the announcement a week from Saturday out at Kleiner Park in Meridian, anticipating that it may have something to do with his paperwork. He filed with the state appointing a treasurer for a gubernatorial run, but don't know exactly, but what a heck of an election and a campaign cycle that we have ahead of us, right?
Yes. And if we need a brain break from all of this, Don, I'm going to give the last word to you. Now, I'm not one of the cool kids who goes to Space Bar downtown, but at least not yet. But somebody's got to be going because it is growing and they're moving. You've got about 1 minute. Give us a sense of what's going on there.
Yeah, so Space Bar, which is at the corner of Capitol Boulevard and Idaho Street in downtown Boise, has been in operation for quite a few years now. And their lease is up. They didn't have enough space in the building. And so they looked for a new spot, and they found one right across the parking lot. People who've lived here a long time will know it as the old Louis building. If you haven't lived here so long, it's kind of the old green building across from Boise City Hall on Idaho Street. And they're going to expand by quite a bit and add some more machines. There will be a permanent stage. There will even be a screen printing business in there. And key for folks who like to go to a bar, they're going to have full liquor. So Space Bar will have more space and more bar, and they hope to have that open this summer.
So there is a connection with politics. There's another bar. Okay.
It is, like, and it's that. Close
more
to the State
space
House.
And more bar.
So you State House reporters will have a new place to go hang out after a long day at the session.
All right. So on that happy note, I'm going to have to cut it off. Thank you all. Many thanks to our reporter roundtable this week, Rachel Cohen from Boise State Public Radio, Clark Carbon of the Idaho Capital Sun, Don Day, founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, and Rachel Spotcheck of the Idaho Statesman. And thank you for joining us. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our theme music is written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. If you have a question or a comment or an idea for the show, send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Our executive producers are Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I'm Kevin Richard from Idaho Education News, filling in for Gemma Gaudette. And you can hear today's program and previous interviews at our website, boisestatepublicradio.org. In the meantime, I'm Kevin Richard. Have a good weekend.